Jazz, 91.9 WCLK, Atlanta's Jazz Station. Jamal Ahmed, the soul of jazz, and I tell you, I'm so honored right now to have a true living legend sitting in front of me, a modern legend, the founder of modern house music, and I'm so honored to have the legendary Little Louis. How you doing, sir?
I am wonderful, thank you.
Man, it's a blessing to have you in studio, because last time we talked, I mean, it had to be like 04, 05 when you came to Atlanta, and it was just on the phone, but a lot of information was dropped. And you've done so much since then. What was that last record you put out back then?
Two Sides to Every Story.
Two Sides to Every Story.
Yeah.
Absolutely brilliant record.
Thank you.
And it was a wonderful return to form. But how have you been thus far?
I feel incredible right now. I mean, I'm on a high creatively that I've never been on. You know, life has been dynamic since we last spoken. My father and my mother have passed. My mom passed about a year ago, and that took me into a real range of emotions. You know, one of the things that I learned, though, was that there was an urgency in me that was confirmed by her passing, because now I realize it was ephemeral. It wasn't, you know, permanent. You were going to move on at some point. And so I think this project and everything just, you know, it was already at the highest level possible, but it went to an even higher level. So I'm walking now with her.
Exactly.
And I'm walking with all of the people that, you know, are urging me on with water.
Was your mother a big influence on you musically?
My mom was a big influence on my life. I get that question. I would say the biggest influence on me is God. There was no model for me when I was starting, because, you know, the DJing thing was a whole different thing. DJs in 1974, when I started, were kind of like radio DJs. You know, you just happened to be at the club. So it was about, you know, you have one big turntable. There was no mixer when I started. And you play a record. And then the record went off. He said, that was the Spinners. And then you, you know, went to, you know, exactly the Herb Kent thing. And so that's what I saw. But that wasn't the model I was interested in. And so, you know, I had to do things from scratch and make a ton of mistakes, you know, along the way. And there was a lot of discouragement because I was pushing against something. I didn't want to be a jukebox. And that's what I saw all DJs as back then. You know, you were told what to play. This is what you play. And so I got fired from every club that I played at, from 74 until 79, every single club. And so, you know, I was pushing through something. And my mother and father helped push me through that. And to be fair to them, they didn't know either. They had no idea. In fact, my mom was still, she was shocked at what I was trying to do, you know, because she had given up music, or given up secular music for God. So, you know, influence, yes. Yes, my mom has influenced almost everything that I do, you know, and I literally walk in her light now.
So you just mentioned from 1974 to 1979, those were your first kind of formative years as a DJ. Let's talk about just something simple as, what was in your record box? What was a R&B. Go-to record? What were some of the go-to records in your box at that time?
Well, you know, Kool & the Gang, Al Green, Marvin Gaye, Donny Hathaway. I liked a lot of things, you know, even Elton John. And that's because my father was a true inspiration to me, because he was the first one to tell me about the you know, how music is colorless. In fact, my father was a janitor at the time, and we were listening to this song called Philadelphia Freedom. And we were going up this hill, and the reason I mentioned the hill is because we had this raggedy station wagon. And we felt if you could get up the hill, you were a success. So we're on the way up to that hill, and Philadelphia Freedom started playing. And my dad looked over at me and said, "You remember, music has no color." And that literally changed my whole perspective on music. And so when I was playing earlier, you know, we were also playing a lot of stepping music from Chicago. So instead of me playing traditional songs, you know, I would also play the Beatles. I would play Led Zeppelin. I felt that good music was good music. And that's probably why I got fired from every place, because I just wouldn't play, you know, whatever was on the radio. Mm. Those songs just really didn't interest me. You know, anything that was really popular kind of went the other way.
Right, right. You were a B-sides kind of guy?
I was absolute B-sides. I was in the very first record pool that ever existed. It was called the Dogs of War. And I was a guinea pig. So people, you know, the guys gave me music because they knew I was either stubborn or stupid enough to play it. And so I would play these songs, and then I'd have the owner come up to me and tell me what I needed to play. And then after I refused, I would get thrown out of the cup. You know, a couple of bouncers would come and escort me out and throw my records out. But the labels liked the fact that I would take chance and I would push these records. And then I started mixing songs too, because there's a secret that I'm going to share with you. I was very insecure about my voice when I first started, because I had a very high-pitched voice. You know, remember Michael before, and then Michael, you know what I mean? And so I was Michael. And so I part of the prerequisite was you had to make an announcement, you know, to tell Vicky to go get a car, or whatever it was that you were saying in the club. And the first time that I was told that I needed to do that, I was so terrified, until I turned the microphone off and I put my head in my legs for like 10 minutes and I was practicing. And then when I turned the microphone on, this pitch came out. No words. It was just, it was the worst thing ever. And then I went to my friend who I looked up to, and he said something awful to me, which I'll reserve for the film. And from that point forward, I said, you know what, I'm never going to talk again. And that was the beginning of a movement as well, because I said, you know what, I'm going to make the music talk for me. And I started mixing from the radio, because we didn't have two turntables. I started mixing from the radio to a turntable. And that's basically what I did before mixers came out. So I would mix in a club so that I would not have to speak.
Mm. You know, it's interesting, because when I think of early house culture, or whatever people want to call it, because to me, house music is almost like jazz. Like, it doesn't really fit that title of what it is. It's something much bigger than just that title, just like jazz music. But I always think that early house, and I see early house kind of parallel to early hip hop. You know, the technological advances. We saw Grandmaster Flash, you know, creating the buttons to be able to mix and spin. And you guys were actually co-opting a lot of that new technology. Mm-hmm. When did we start seeing this music become house music? When did you start seeing that?
Well, you know, I think what's important, and I can say this because I was there from the absolute inception and beginning of it, is, you know, titles are one thing. A movement is something else. Titles are titles. But long before the title house music came about, there was a movement. And beyond the movement, there was a culture. And so that happened in the 70s. That didn't happen in the 80s. And a lot of that happened from oppression. It happened from life. Just as blues happened from life. Blues didn't happen because there were a couple of guys talented with guitars. My father was on Chess Records. And I used to sit in the garage and watch him talk to Howlin' Wolf and talk to Muddy Waters. My mother actually dated Little Walter. And my father took my mother away from Little Walter. So that's how ensconced I am in this movement, you know. So I used to sit in the garage, 3-4 years old, and listen to these stories. And the stories were crazy, you know. And if you think about Marvin Gaye, Donny Hathaway, you think about some of the great Stevie Wonder, some of the great albums. They came from something, from a cultural thing that happened. What's Going On came from the fact that you know, he and the musicians and the writers, Leon Ware and all these guys, were talking about Vietnam and all of these things. from that came the melody and the space and the words that we put together is what's going on. And so house music was a derivative of what was still going on in Chicago. You know, the racism and all of the craziness that was happening there. So, you know, when people say, well, house music is a feeling. Oh, no, it's a lot more than a feeling. It's a lot more than that. A feeling is based on something. You know, you look at a girl and that feeling comes from her breasts, or it comes from her smile, or it comes from the ambiance. So you can't say that it's a feeling. It is so much deeper than that. And so we wrote from that. And then Disco Demolition Night tried to kill that. But what it actually did, it induced more.
Can you stay just right there just for a quick second? Because sure. Our listeners may not be familiar with that very pivotal event that happened up in Chicago. I think that happened in 1979.
1979, July.
Yeah, what was that all about?
Well, what that was about at that point, dance music. Let's take it out of the disco, all the titles. Dance music had really kind of apexed for the first time. I saw an uprise in DJs. All of a sudden, you know, because in the early 70s, very few of us. There just weren't a lot of us. By 76, 77, all of a sudden, I'm seeing these people calling themselves DJs. In fact, one guy called himself Little Lewis and was going around passing out flyers saying he was Little Lewis, and he was hurting my reputation because he was awful. But it had gotten to that point, you know, that everybody was a DJ. And so by 1979, disco was it as per pop culture. That was it. And so this guy, Steve Dahl, decided that he was going to end that because rock music had started taking a lot less of the pie. And so he created this horrible night called Disco Demolition at White Sox Park. And they blew up not only disco records, they blew up black records. And so immediately after that, the disco, as we know, was dead. The whole culture was murdered. You know, we could not, you know, go to clubs. You know, I couldn't, all the venues that I had access to and had shut me off, it said, no, we don't want you here anymore. And now they're playing rock. And I started seeing the remnants of rap. You know, a lot of DJs had started playing Rapper's Delight, which came out, you know, same year, which was a derivative of Good Times. So, you know, you can say what you want, but it came from disco, didn't it? Right. So, you know, what I said to a couple of the main DJs, I won't mention names until the film, but think about the main DJs, and this is all of them. Don't stop. We're good. We just have to keep telling the story. And I went to a couple of places, and I was very disappointed that these main DJs were now playing Jocko and playing Rapper's Delight and playing all of these songs with rap in them. And I said, no, I can tell you without question that we can still sell a lot of copies. In fact, part of the reason I said in New Dance Beat, they used to laugh at me, but I saw the future, was because in 1979, I told these DJs that I was going to sell a million copies one day, and they all laughed at me. But I saw the future. And so, you know, I started, my mom suggested that I get a drum machine, and that goes back to my mom, and she said, so I got an 808. It's my first drum machine, my first major drum machine. And, you know, we started going to town.
Wow. You know, it's interesting, too, because when you look at that pivotal night in 1979, it seems like what you did was rise out of those ashes like a phoenix and create this whole new thing. That was, you know, when I think about what you were doing in the 1980s, it was, and you talk about your influences, like early soul and R&B, what you were doing was a distinct kind of break off from
question.
That.
No
you
question.
Know, it was like starting a whole new thing.
Yeah. And to that point, see, I think that there's a difference between influence and inspiration. I have a lot of inspirations. I would say that Led Zeppelin is probably more of an inspiration to me than a lot of black music. Now, I'm not saying that to denigrate my music, because that's mine too. But Led Zeppelin is mine. You know, my first real experience with authority, not power, was my father sold Good Humor Ice Cream. And so he would sell at Chicago Stadium. And the promoter that used to promote all the big events became friends with my dad. And so he told my dad, listen, would you like for your son to come in and, you know, and see like some, you know, artists or whatever, would, you know, see the concert? And say, yeah, yeah, you know. So my father was like, yeah, go in. So the first concert I ever went to was Led Zeppelin. So I walk into Led Zeppelin. He puts me in the front seat, this promoter, and all I could see was this man's tight pants and genitals and and directing, and every move that this man made was just seducing 25,000 people. And I realized in that moment that if you understand the art and you're truly connected with it, that you have the authority to affect masses in that beautiful way. And everything that I've ever made is with that in mind. Not just reaching one, but really reaching, telling enough of a story to have the authority to connect with everyone. That's what Led Zeppelin did.
That explains a lot, actually. It really does, because when I look at you, you know, when I think about you, and I remember hearing the first time I was hip, because I'm from Atlanta,
right?
And the first time I was hip to you was my freshman year in college over there at Morehouse, and I heard the album Journey with the Lonely. And it was a very, it was an interesting moment for me, because that was the first time where I really connected with house music.
Right.
I'd heard it before, mm-hmm. but there was something in what you were doing. I connected with that. And not only that, but I said, this guy reminds me, when I listened to you and heard you talk, the first person that came to mind was Prince.
Mm-hmm.
It was almost like you represented that kind of enigmatic, you know, energy that Prince had, that subtle, silent genius that he never had to tell anyone.
Right.
He displayed it in his actions, and you took the music to a whole nother level. And the most seminal tune, of course, that really was a turning point was French Kiss.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Talk about French Kiss, because, you know, we've danced. I can remember some incredible moments on the dance floor with some beautiful women.
Oh,
with
yeah.
French Kiss.
All right.
But talk about that particular record and just, you know, the inspiration. Where did it come from?
Well, you know, as I said earlier, it's about life. You know, it's not just a feeling, but it's life. So there was this young lady, I won't mention her name because we have an agreement. And you know, she and I, we were on the phone, we were dating at the time. And everyone understands when you get to that moment. There's a line that you cross, and it goes from how are you doing to what are you wearing? So we went to that, the what are you wearing thing. And so in the middle of this, she tells me this story, and it's the craziest story. She starts talking about this other guy. So I'm like, what? Wait a minute. She said, I want to tell you about this other guy. I've never told anyone this story, by the way. So she's telling me about this guy. And this guy was really incredibly handsome, really fine. And so now I'm on the phone like, what? You want to tell me about something? Okay, let me go with it. You know what I mean? I'm not jealous. I'm cool, you know. So she's telling me about this guy. And then she said, you know, and then when we got ready and when it was time to make love, I was really excited. I was really turned on. And as soon as I hugged him, he started trembling. And I said, what? He started trembling. So I'm like, no. And she said, he actually had an orgasm just from a hug. So she's mad. She's frustrated, you know. But she said, this guy was so handsome. Now I'm laughing. She said, but he was so handsome. I'm like, you gave him another shot, right? She said, yeah, I had to give him another shot. So the next week they get together, whatever. And he's like, babe, I'm going to be good this time. I promise you, you know, I had to get that energy off and I'm ready. So, like, you know, they're getting in the moment or whatever. They make it to the bed. They make it to the bed now. So he won, I guess, in his mind. So as soon as he entered, he starts trembling again. And she's like, no, don't get out. So she throws this guy out. And so I'm sitting there like, why is she telling me that? She said, the reason I'm telling you that story is because, you know, when I think about you, I think about how much time you take when you make love to me. So I'm like, oh, that's the most clever thing a woman had ever done to me. So now when I'm relaxed, well, yeah, so tell me about this, you know, this slowness, you know. And at the time when she was talking, I had this song on in the background, the music for French Kiss. So as she's talking about me slowing it down, I started slowing the song down. And as soon as I slowed it down to about 60 beats, I dropped the phone. So I said, oh. And I knew I needed to do something then, special, artistically. So I got back up on the phone, naked. I said, baby, I'm sorry. I have to call you back. And so I called her back, and I started working on, you know, how to put this. Because remember, this was before computers. So the process of slowing it down in pitch and key, it was a very arduous act to literally use analytics and physics to do that. And so after I figured it out, I called her back the next, I think it was 2 days later. I said, you need to meet me in the studio, and we need to do something.
Was that her?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And the agreement was, you can never, ever tell people my name. So I was like, oh, let's go with that. That's French Kiss.
I mean, that's the perfect story for French Kiss. And I mean, it goes to the point that I was saying about Prince. There is, you know, that sensuality in that tune. And there's also the spirituality.
Absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
There's a God energy in there as well. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What did that record do for you? We know what it did, but what did you see it do for yourself?
It inspired and confused me. It completely confused me because I never wanted to be an artist. You know, Prince and I, we did have a lot of discussions. There's a lot of things that I don't tell the public because it wasn't important, and our conversations that he and I had were not for the public to know. But the one major difference between the two of us was he always wanted it, and I never really wanted it. I wanted to express myself, but I never wanted to be on stage in front. So all of a sudden, I'm thrusted in this limelight that I didn't want. And so it was very uncomfortable, but I'm not afraid of discomfort. It was just a challenge to acclimate. So, you know, if you watch a lot of the interviews, you can see that I'm struggling with the fame of it. And not in a non-appreciative way, because I really did appreciate. I appreciate any fan that is moved or affected, or DJ that's influenced by what I've done. To this day, a couple of months ago, I was in this audience. I was in Paris, and they gave me a 20-minute standing ovation because I did this long set. And I got shy. I didn't know how to really respond to it, you know? And so even now, I'm appreciative of it. But if I had my way, the public would just hear my expression. They would see my art. They would never have to see me. And I learned through this French Kiss journey, through being on Epic Records, that they needed to see me too. Now I'm good with it. Now I'm okay. Because I know that as soon as I do this, and you know, I go to do the album review tomorrow, and I kiss the public and shake their hands and show them affection, I can go home and close my door and keep writing. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
And so, you know, I've learned that there's a responsibility in that too.
Well, it seems like you were made for, I don't want to say the limelight, but I mean, just your look alone, like, you know how some people have that, like, oh, man, who is that guy? You know, when you see folk walk in, it's like he does something. It's something that he does. And you have that look, man. So it seems like if you didn't do that, it would almost be a letdown to what you were created for.
No question. Now, to that point, you know, I was just telling someone about being gifted. I think there are a lot of people who are gifted. And I will own that. But a lot of people who are gifted don't realize that you don't give yourself the gift. In order to be gifted, someone has to give you the gift, or something has to give you the gift. God gave me this gift. So there's a humility in understanding that. And there's a necessity in me understanding that in order for me to realize my gift. So I never look at that and say, well, this is me. And this is, you know, I'm bigger than anything. I'm you know, the biggest that I could ever hope to be is small. And so I think I had to come to realize that by stepping into a light, it doesn't do anything to denigrate my love and my respect and my honor for God. You understand what I'm saying?
Right.
And my father said right before he died that, you know, he expressed about the meek and humble shall inherit the earth. And he said, Lewis, I think you confused it. I think you felt that you needed to be meek and humble. You confused the conjunction. Mm. You can be humble and not necessarily meek. And I think that was something that I really needed to hear. He said that to me a week before he passed away.
Wow.
And so now, you know, I enjoy the light because I know my purpose in it.
Right.
I know that, you know, Prince and myself and people who have been gifted, you know, we are supposed to go out and do what David did.
Mm-hmm.
That's my job.
Right, right.
You know.
You know, it's interesting that you're here at Jazz 91.9 WCLK because this is the first place that I heard your music. You're
okay.
the first radio station. And God bless Mr. Kim Beatty. I'm sitting
Absolutely.
In his seat now, but he was the gentleman that was playing your music back in 1992.
All
you
right.
know, 25 years ago. Can you believe it?
How about it?
You know, a quarter of a century ago, you created probably the greatest recording in dance music history, which is Journey with the Lonely. And when you look at that record from start to finish, it is an opus of unparalleled proportion. I mean, I don't really see many records even today that can compare to that record because there's so much that you're doing on that particular album.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's that jazz piece. I noticed with your sound, and especially with that record, there were these beautiful chords that were coming in
mm-hmm.
that you normally didn't hear in dance music.
Mm-hmm.
What were you trying to do with that particular album?
Well, for me, it was really about pushing myself to make a better version of the first album. Because, you know, there are a lot of people that fall victim to the sophomore jinx. I never cared about that. That never mattered to me because my philosophy has always been, if I'm doing my best, if I know that I've done the absolute most that I can do, I've already won. Cannot lose. With the first album, there were holes in that album. And even though people, you know, honored me for it, and I appreciate that, I have to live with it too. You know what I mean? I have to live with it first. And so, you know, we were given 10 days to do an album, the first album, because of the Sony deal. And so I did not really like the glue. I did not like the continuity of it. I felt there was a bunch of singles. And there was a little bit of a story there. But with Journey with the Lonely, I decided, no, I'm going to tell a story, and it's going to be a story from the beginning, the first note, all the way through the end. And one of the first things I did was recognize where I was, you know, and that was, in that moment, I had a lot of people around me, but I was very lonely. Now, that's something that it did to me. You asked, mm-hmm. you know, that's another thing. I felt, even though all these people are shaking my hands, I felt isolated. And so I moved to London, which sounds crazy. I actually moved to London and I decided, you know, I don't want to date anyone. I don't want to date any girls. I want to, for the first time, I don't want to try to fill this emptiness in bed. I want to just explore this loneliness. Where does it come from? And so the songs and the lyrics that I wrote, you can kind of tell, you can see that. You know, there's a young man that's trying to find his way from adulthood to wisdom. And I think that if I accomplished anything, I probably accomplished that because some of the songs speak to vulnerability, which is the road to wisdom and the road to greatness. You have to be vulnerable. And it's a scary road, but I think we accomplished it. And I think that's why it lasted. That's why it's still here because people are still walking that road. You've walked that road. We're all walking that road. You know what I mean?
Right. You know, there's a tune on there probably one of the greatest songs of the 90s and beyond, Thief. Is that you singing on that?
It is.
You know, whenever I listen to that song and your voice on that song, it's like I hear this, I don't know, I want to say a Sade-esque thing, but it's not that.
Right.
It's like a whole nother vibe.
Yeah.
And the lyrics in that song are absolutely like deep underground, like it's something you're saying some stuff on there. I mean, the fact that you're saying comparing someone who stole your heart as a thief, that's very classic kind of romantic poetry from the neoclassical period or whatnot, man.
Thank you.
What was that tune all about? And I just want to ask that from a personal perspective because
sure.
that's my favorite.
Okay. That tune was about this young lady that I met in New York. I went to London for a year, didn't date anyone, and it was one of the loneliest periods of my life. And the second that I went to New York, I met this girl from London. So I started dating her, and we had this intense, sensual, sexual thing. It was kindred. You know, there were so many nuances to it. And then I found out that she was married. And she didn't want to tell me that. She was in the middle of trying to decide on a divorce. Her husband beat on her. I read about it in the book. And she had to make a choice of staying with her husband to avoid losing her child or staying with me. So I let her go. But I let her know that you stole my heart, that it was gone, that my heart was with you. And so, you know, when you look at the expression of the lyrics as well as the lyrics, you can see that there was genuine pain there. And it was genuine pain because it was genuine love. You know what I mean? I think those the most tragic songs are the most beautiful songs and vice versa, you know, because it's always an opposite thing going.
Right, right. And there's almost like a Chet Baker type of vibe with that particular song. It's classic, smoky, you know, jazz. It was almost like pre-neo soul. It was a whole bunch of things.
Yeah.
That song represented.
And you know, the jazz part of it, I will say this real quick, the jazz part of it came because, you know, I was raised in blues, but blues for the most part is 1-4-5 without getting geeky. 1-4-5, you know, 5 going back to the 1. And so that bored me quickly. And so I wanted actually to start using deceptive cadence, not going to the 1 from the 5, figuring out another chord to take you somewhere differently. And that also began this new journey into two sides of every story and into now, because the more deceptive I was experiencing, you know, these chords, the more deceptive I wanted to get. And so even like with Never Ending Song, you know, there are so many chords in that song, but what tied it were the lyrics. Mm-hmm. You know, I simplified it with the lyrics. But if you look at the progression, it's basically almost a 26 bar progression where it just keeps going, keeps going, keeps going. But, you know, in that moment, for me, it was about deceptive cadence. So that was what bridged jazz to classical, because now it's more about classical for me than it is about jazz. Mm-hmm. So I went from blues to jazz, to classical.
I mean, it's a natural progression backwards to cover those bases and come back up in the future.
Absolutely.
And I mean, speaking of the future, you have embarked on something, I don't even know if lofty is a term, with this new project.
Right.
What's it called, first and foremost? I don't even know if it's an it, because you are releasing how many records?
Yeah, I'm releasing 6 albums back to back. And so the last 6 years, something happened. As you are, I'm sure, aware, I was going to come up with a film. And I'm still going to come up with a film on the real history of house music. And so in 2012, something crazy happened to me. Actually, it was 2011, late 2011. And so from that event, I started feeling that I needed to do something, because things changed, music changed, life changed. And in order for me to stay curious, I had to go with my curiosity, you know? And so I started writing from this adversity. And what ended up happening was I was in the lab, I call it the lab, for the last 6 years, 20, 21 hours a day. And I came up with 1,600 songs. I have a little bit over 1,600 songs that I've written, and I'm not talking about filler songs. I'm talking about actual songs. And so I tried to put one album together, and I realized I can't do this in one album. So I tried to put 2 albums together. I'm like, oh, it's not enough for 2 albums. And I was finally satisfied with 6. So we're coming out with 6 albums back to back.
Is there something in that number 6 for you on that? Because there's some deep meaning with that number.
Yeah, you know what? To be honest, I think that instinctively and transcendentally, maybe, yes. But I wanted to get to a certain kind of expression that makes it whole. I think every album does that. You know what I mean? Every film does that. There's a certain moment where you say, okay, it's whole now. It's, you know, I've told the story, this story. And I just kept searching and I kept realizing there was so much more to what I was trying to say about house music, dance music, life, black, not just black life, but life in general. And I couldn't convey it in a film, you know, just by telling, you know, doing one film, it just wasn't enough. And I couldn't convey it in one album. And now with six albums and this film and something else that I will announce tomorrow, now I feel like, okay, the expression is complete. I can move forward, you know. And we can use, you know, a lot of those other songs. You know, we'll use them in film scores. We'll use them down the road. Because one thing that I'm proud of is now you're going to hear the cinematic value of what I do as an artist and producer. Because, you know, a few of the songs are just complete acoustical, you know, cinematic songs. One song, for instance, is 148 tracks. And, you know, we have full orchestration in that song. And wow. We're going to go from that to the most raw Chicago song you could ever imagine. You know, so the album has complete range.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned Chicago because I was on Facebook recently and saw folk who went to the album review in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, oh, Lewis ain't playing. They had to check in the cell phones. And
oh, yeah.
You know, because you don't want any leaks, which I totally understand.
Right.
And that does break up the beauty and mystery of things.
Yeah.
But what everyone was saying when they walked out, everyone had to report and everyone said, y'all, I don't know what that was, but it was like going to church. You know, everybody felt something different, but everybody felt fulfilled.
Right.
What is it that you are trying to do with this particular record? Because this record is something that dance music has never seen.
Yeah. Yeah, I think for me, more than anything is moving it into the future, because I think one of the problems that I see is there's a little bit too much reflection as for house music with the past. And I get it. You know, I get it. I was there. So I know the feeling. But, you know, even going back to this adversity that happened to me in 11, 12, you know, I learned that music, life, moves forward. If you don't move forward with it, you will be stuck in whatever that moment was. And so I think, as we did in the 70s, and you know, as I've done in the 70s and the 80s and onward, I look at what's happening, the landscape, and try to move it that way. You know, so this album is definitely looking way into the future, but it's also celebrating and honoring the roots, and you'll hear a lot of that. But it's moving. It's not just four on the floor, 124. It's so much more than that.
Mm.
Yeah, you're going to have musicality big time.
I mean, and going back to your statement, you know, they laughed at me, but I saw the future.
Mm-hmm.
What do you perceive as the future for the 21st century? You know, there's something that everyone is trying to wrap their heads around right now as to what are we going to do, because everything seems like it was done in the 20th century.
Right.
There aren't any new genres. You know, things don't seem to be moving as it was in the 20th century.
Right. Well, you know, to that point, people say that there's nothing new because all the chords have been played. That's just simply not true. The combinations are new. So what I'm showing are a bunch of different combinations. You know, I'm playing with time signatures in ways that they've never been played with. You know, one of the songs that I'm doing has three different time signatures and they're operating at the same time. So so if you're dancing, you know, in one perspective, you'll be moving this way, and another perspective, you'll be moving this way, and in the third perspective, you're moving it. Well, is it right? Does it still come back to the one? That's never been done, and that's cool. You know, I want someone to do eight albums.
Right.
You know, I want someone to go harder into, you know, the acoustical property of music. I want someone to manipulate space a little bit more. You know, I'm really going after space now in these records. You know, I'm you know, because space is a value. It's not just a melody. Space is a value. Blues taught us that. So, you know, I'm really using space, you know.
I'm a big fan of space, man.
Absolutely.
I mean, my name is Jamal Ahmed, Ahmad Jamal. He was the King
there
of
it
Space.
Is. There it is. You That's know, right.
He taught Miles Space.
Oh, no question. You know? And Miles taught John Coltrane yeah. Space. See, that's what I mean. Like, I think right now we're trying to be jazzy. You know, we're trying to emulate something jazzy. And so you hear a lot of this music that it was fusion, which is confusion to me because you don't know where you're going with it and why you're even there. Mm-hmm. So it's like the jazz clubs. Part of the reason they died was because, you know, you had a bunch of people clapping to something they didn't know.
Mm.
French sounds beautiful to me for 2 minutes, you know, but if I don't understand it, at a certain point, I'm tuning it out. You know what I mean? And so what I want to make sure that we get across is, you know, making sure this is palatable. You can digest this, even though, you know, it's moving in a way you might not quite understand because of what's on top, because of the space that we're using, because of how we're coming back to it. You know, I don't want to get geeky five, but
no.
Talking about music, man.
I mean, but you just said something that is really poignant, and it kind of leads into my next question. You were talking about creating something that is palatable, accessible.
Right, absolutely.
And when I look at all the folk that you have inspired, I mean, even and Jason Orr and I were talking about this the other day about how. When you listen to the music, of course, you were sampled by Lil' Kim, you
right.
know, and
right.
when you listen to the music of, say, Nicki Minaj and Drake and Jidania and just all these, even Katy Perry and all of them,
mm-hmm.
you hear your influence.
Absolutely.
I mean, the fact that on the Daft Punk album, I think it was the tune Teachers,
right.
was it Teachers?
Right.
And you're mentioned, right. like they say, listen, we would not be who we are
right.
if it wasn't for Lil' Louis
right.
and Daft Punk. One of the greatest new bands
mm-hmm.
of
mm-hmm.
now,
mm-hmm.
you know, Grammy Award winning, big tunes.
Absolutely.
What does that feel like when you hear, you know, those people acknowledge you?
It feels like I'm living up to God's gift. Because, you know, David had no value unless he reached the people. He had no value, if you really think about it. And so I have no value unless I reach the artists and my fans, you know, so everything that I do, every single thing that I do, and I know, you know, people have given me a reputation of being a perfectionist. I own some of that. But the reason I am a perfectionist is for my fans. It's for people that are coming, that are spending their money to hear me, that are sitting there going through a situation, and they just need something to allay their feelings, get them away from something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it goes back to one of the most beautiful moments of my life. I used to get these parties at the Bismarck, and there was one moment where this guy came in with $20 in pennies, and he had scraped up these pennies to get into this party. And my mom said, should we let him in free? Because, you know, he only has these pennies. And no, he's a man. Let him pay, but I'm going to honor him. So I brought him up to the stage, and I had him stay up there with me the whole night. And the point of that was that I fell in love with the reason he did it, you know? And it made me realize that what I was doing was affecting someone, you know, in that way. So the fact that Daft Punk and, you know, even Frankie, you know, Frankie talked about how I inspired him and, you know, some of the other DJs and other people that
David
have come.
David Guetta.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And, you know, I feel that is part of my responsibility, moving it forward, because if I try to carry it all myself, that's just an impossible. First, it's an impossibility, and it's a selfish, ego-driven endeavor.
Mm.
So I absolutely love pushing it and being honored by that.
So let's talk about tonight. You're going to be doing a review of this new album.
Oh, right.
Now, are people going to hear? What are they going to hear?
Okay, so I'm actually taking songs from three of the six albums. And so we're going to present these songs. You can imagine the most intense party that you've ever seen in your life, married to MTV Unplugged. And the baby is the album review. So it's going to be a very intimate look at my life, my journey into this project, but we're going to dance.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a traditional album review at all.
Ah.
I mean, you know, I've had the album reviews now in London, Ministry, I had it in Paris, Rex Club, and Kiev. in Glasgow. We just brought it to Boston and Chicago, and now we're here. And the response is insane. You know, we're filming it, so people are dancing, you know, and really enjoying that moment, because it's also a historic thing. You know, I'm doing this in part because I thought about all the stuff that we did that wasn't recorded back then, wasn't filmed back then. And it would have been beautiful for people to be a part of the French Kiss history. This is an opportunity for them to be part of this new history. Mm. And to say 20 years from now, you know what? I went to that album review and I heard that song and I saw this young man before he went on to do X, Y, and Z.
Mm. You know, my mother used to say this thing to me when I first started DJing back in, I mean, my career. I was actually born the year you started DJing.
Right.
when I started DJing, my mother said, well, if you're going to start DJing, you better know that people don't trust DJs who can't dance.
And how about it?
I used to be like, what do you mean? And she's like, you got to entertain.
I love that.
You got to give it to the people.
That's right.
And I've always kept that to my heart. You know, whenever I go out, do you feel that same ethos?
Oh, almost? No question. I mean, you know, when I play, it's exactly the same thing. At times when I get carried away, like, I looked at this footage because I'm looking through the footage of the film, and I was at this Rex Club, and I was dancing so hard until my face was literally, I don't know how close it was to the mixer, but if I'd gone down another eighth of an inch, I would have busted my head. But, you know, when I'm in the moment, I'm not even a DJ. It's like there's a oneness there. You understand that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like the room is taken over by the light, and we're all just, you know, following the light, you know? And so I agree with your mom 100%. And even though you probably won't ever see me in the middle of the dance floor, you'll see me with the glass.
Well, you know, I can tell her that she saw the future.
That's it. You absolutely can't tell her that.
And I tell her that you co-signed that.
That's right.
Man. She loves your music too, man.
I'll tell her. Thank you.
Big fan.
Beautiful.
Well, is there anything else you want to cover, man? Because there's so much that we can talk about.
Yeah.
We've talked about a lot. But is there anything you want to leave our listeners with?
Well, one thing I do want to say is that what I decided to do was to invest in my fans. And here's what I mean by that. I think one of the reasons why people kind of credit me as being the founding father of house is not exclusively because of the music that I made, but it's because of the investment that I made, because I pushed the culture. And I can say that proudly, that I pushed and shaped the culture because of what I put into it. You know, to me, it was always bigger than music, like hip hop is bigger than music. And so, you know, you do that by investing in a production, investing in the sound, investing in the studio, making sure you spend the money that you need to make the quality so it can be compared to a Donny Hathaway, as opposed to trying to make a small track. And that is all but gone now. It's gone. And so when you think about album reviews and you think about things like that, especially as for house music, you typically are left to think small. So I've put a lot of money into this. I'm bringing a custom sound system everywhere that I go. And I mean an intense sound system. So I will say this, if you're very sensitive to sound, go to the back of the room.
Mm-hmm. Bring your plugs.
Yeah. It's going to be clarity there. It's going to be real clarity. So you probably won't need plugs, but you can feel some bass.
Mm.
You can feel some bottom. And I do that because I don't want the perception of house to be perpetuated as small in some small club. Yeah, I love the underground thing forever. But this is about the world. We have affected the world. So I am investing in this. And I'd like for my fans to invest in it too. Come to experience this. Come open. And let's go back to, you know, something that is special that we're not dictating. You know, the songs, these albums are not about that. It's just about a connectivity between two people, the fan, the artist.
You know, before I let you go, what you just touched on, it seems like the missing link to modern music culture. You know, you have so many fans. I can't even call folk fans if they don't support, you know, real fans come and support. They will drop something and make sure that they show you.
That's the investment part.
That's exactly it. And it seems like because there's so much free stuff that people have thought that that's how things should be. But it's almost like, well, if you expect free food, what are you going to get? You know, there's only so many options you can get when you expect free food every single day.
Yeah.
And so when you look at it, it just really seems like people have lost that peace.
Well, to that point, I think, you know, if this event, by the way, is free, but the investment that I'm asking for people to make is come open and come to support it. Mm-hmm. That's the investment. That's the exchange.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're coming with your set expectations, then you're not contributing. You know, that's what house music was back in the day and disco was back in the day. The fans would walk in and they would just dance. They let the DJ go wherever he wanted to go and they were with him. As long as he told the story, his obligation is to tell the story. Well, I'm going to meet my obligation. I would like for my fans to meet the obligation as well. Just come with open hearts and let's do this as a community, you know, that believes in the bigger picture of house music and not the smaller picture.
So the event is happening Thursday,
yeah.
August 31st tonight, 7 to 11 p.m.
Right, and it's free, but you know,
you have to go to Eventbrite.
You have to go to Eventbrite and get your tickets and
mm-hmm. and RSVP.
Yeah. Right, you get those tickets free, but you need to do it right away because we are running out of tickets.
Okay, and this is going to be at 595
North. 595 North Event Center.
Okay,
absolutely.
Okay. And I mean, you're in town, man, for the big thing. This is our coup d'etat in Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
House in the Park.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we are doing an event at Wild Pitch Underground on Saturday, and to continue this movement, I'm doing an all night set.
And I gotta bring your brother in here, and have a one on one with him, DJ Pierre.
Mm-hmm. That's my baby boy.
Yeah, because he did his own thing and started a whole new lane.
Pierre, I absolutely love him. Yeah. You know, what he has accomplished, what he has accomplished, and what he is about to accomplish, you know, is something I'm very proud of.
Hey, he is, I mean, just to have you two in the city at the same time, we got to have a lot of security around because
how about it?
it's some precious cargo floating around the ATL this weekend. Well, God bless you, little Lewis.
All right, brother.
We look forward to seeing you tonight at 595 North Avenue and, of course, at Wild Pitch on Saturday. And, of course, we look forward to this incredible, epic journey of six albums.
That's it. And more to come after.
Oh, that's what I wanted to hear.
Onward.
And upward.
That's it.
Take care, man.
All right, brother.